Hello, everyone. This is the July CJSON podcast, and my name is Connie Reed from the VA Greater Los Angeles Healthcare System and the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. And I am truly honored to serve as the fourth editor-in-chief of CJSON. CJSON is now in its 18th year, and in addition to being the most widely read nephrology journal in the US, the journal receives over 1,600 original research submissions from across the world on an annual basis. CJSON is well known for publishing clinically impactful, high quality, and rigorous research, and is highly consumed by a diverse readership comprised of clinicians, researchers, trainees, and patients in nephrology. This is a testament to the tremendous dedication and seminal contributions made by Dr. Raj Malhotra, the past CJSON editor-in-chief, current JSON editor-in-chief, and senior editor-in-chief of the ASN Journal Portfolio, Dr. Bill Bennett and Dr. Gary Kerhan, who led the journal as the inaugural editors-in-chiefs, and the ASN Journal Portfolio team. Throughout my own career, the ASN and CJSON have had a major positive impact in shaping my path in academic nephrology, motivating my direction in clinical research, and serving as a critical source of my curriculum. Hence, I consider it the highest honor to serve in the role of editor-in-chief and to lead a world-class team of editors in which we are committed to making a positive, meaningful, and enduring impact on our field. I am joined here today by our two CJSON deputy editors, Dr. Bob Roshanravan and Dr. Sagar Nigokar, in which we'll be highlighting three high-impact articles published in the July issue of CJSON. Over the coming months, we will be featuring monthly podcasts that include editor's choice articles, author-led podcasts, and author and patient voice interviews. I would like to kick off our inaugural podcast by introducing our deputy editor, Bob Roshanravan from the University of California, Davis, who will be discussing the article, Utility of Blood Biomarkers to Predict Marrow Iron Stores in Children with ESKD, in which the corresponding author is Dr. Shilpa Sharma.
Thank you, Connie. Accurate detection of iron deficiency is particularly important in children since children have increased iron requirements for growth, neurocognitive development, and physical functioning. In children and adults with advanced CKD, inflammation may confound the interpretation of iron biomarkers. We often rely on ferritin and transferrin saturation in both populations. In adults with CKD, KDIGO guidelines recommend iron supplementation when ferritin is less than or equal to 500 and TSAT is less than or equal to 30%. And in pediatric CKD, iron supplementation is recommended when ferritin is less than or equal to 100 and TSAT is less than or equal to 20%. This study by Sharma and colleagues investigates the utility and accuracy of biomarkers for detecting iron deficiency in children with kidney failure, comparing them to the gold standard of bone marrow iron stores. Investigators analyzed bone marrow biopsies of 71 clinically stable children and young adults aged 2 to 28 years old who were receiving dialysis and who underwent bone marrow biopsy for different research projects between 2007 to 2011. These children and young adults had to have been treated with maintenance dialysis, either hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis, for at least 3 months. These bone marrow samples were stained for iron and independently interpreted by a pathologist who was blinded to the labs and the clinical status of the patients. In this cross-sectional study, it included 71 patients with a mean age of 17 years and 30% prevalence of females. 56% of the patients were treated with peritoneal dialysis and 44% were treated with hemodialysis. Mean hemoglobin was 12.4, 32% of patients were on oral iron, 22% of patients were on IV iron therapy, and 37% of patients were already treated with EPO. The main study results showed first, a relatively high rate of 46% of the patients were classified as iron deficient based on trace marrow iron stores. Interestingly, there was also no meaningful difference in the mean hemoglobin comparing those who had absent marrow iron stores to those who had replete marrow iron stores. Second, among the peripheral blood iron biomarkers, ferritin was most strongly correlated with marrow iron stores. Third, in unadjusted analyses, higher ferritin, TSAT, and older age were associated with greater marrow iron stores, but after adjusting for potential confounders, only higher ferritin and older age were associated with greater marrow iron stores. This association was not modified by inflammation. There are several key takeaway findings from this study. The first is that ferritin best discriminated marrow iron stores, followed by TSAT. A ferritin level of 188 was the optimal cutoff to discriminate marrow staining defined iron deficiency with an AUC of 0.87 and with a sensitivity of 91% and a specificity of 73%. In comparison, a TSAT of 29% had an AUC of 0.75 and sensitivity of 62% and specificity of 49% for discriminating marrow staining defined iron deficiency. Second key takeaway finding is that the standard clinical cutoff for iron deficiency of ferritin less than or equal to 100 and TSAT less than or equal to 20% missed a high proportion of children and young adults with marrow defined iron deficiency based on absence of marrow iron staining. Using the study cutoff for iron deficiency of ferritin less than or equal to 188 and TSAT less than or equal to 22% improved detection of those with marrow defined iron deficiency from 22% to 55%. What is missing from this study, however, is a better understanding of functional iron deficiency, where perhaps more research is needed. Functional iron deficiency is when iron tests do not indicate depletion of the body's iron stores, but the patient responds to the addition of iron with increasing hemoglobin at a constant level of ESA dose. Some have suggested that bone marrow iron staining may lack the ability to detect functional iron deficiency. Future studies are needed in this field, however, to detect determinants and consequences of functional iron deficiency in these populations.
Thank you, Bob, for this wonderful synopsis. I would now like to introduce our deputy editor, Sagar Nigwekar, from the Massachusetts General Hospital, who will be discussing the article, Kinetics of Beta-2 Microglobulin with Hemodiafiltration Filtration and High-Flux Hemodialysis, in which the corresponding author is Dr. John DeGurtis.
Thank you, Dr. Ri. So the article here that we are going to discuss is very important to understand the role of different schedules of hemodialysis and hemodialysis and hemodiafiltration, excuse me, on predicted pre-dialysis and time-averaged serum beta-2 microglobulin concentrations. And to better understand, a recent randomized comparison between hemodiafiltration and hemodialysis. As many of you know, last year, results from a pragmatic trial that compared the effect of hemodiafiltration to hemodialysis on mortality in patients with kidney failure was published. Briefly, that trial, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, assessed the benefits and harms of high-dose hemodiafiltration to conventional high-flux hemodialysis in over 1,300 patients with kidney failure. In that trial, patients who were treated with hemodialysis for at least 3 months were assigned to receive either high-dose hemodiafiltration with a convective volume of equal to or more than 23 liters in the post-dilution mode per session, or to continue with high-flux hemodialysis. The primary outcome of that trial was death from any cause. During a median follow-up of 30 months, the risk of death from any cause was lower in patients receiving high-dose hemodiafiltration compared to those who were receiving hemodialysis. The survival effect of hemodiafiltration appeared to be limited to those patients who did not have history of cardiovascular disease or of diabetes. One of the limitations of that previous trial was that the inclusion criteria may have resulted in a trial population that was healthier than the general population receiving chronic hemodialysis. Nevertheless, this trial generated a lot of interest in terms of comparing these two modalities of kidney replacement therapy. The present article in the CJSN is important in terms of understanding the role of different schedules of hemodialysis and hemodiafiltration on the predicted pre-dialysis and time-averaged serum beta-2 microglobulin concentrations, and to put it in the perspective, the recent randomized comparison between hemodiafiltration and hemodialysis. In this study, the authors use a kinetic model for beta-2 microglobulin removal and generation to explore the impact of adding hemodiafiltration on pre-dialysis and time-averaged serum values. As the authors describe in the methods, the model was tested on data from the HEMO study and on a sample of patients undergoing high-flux hemodialysis. The impact of hemodiafiltration on beta-2 microglobulin concentration was evaluated by modeling four randomized studies that compared hemodiafiltration to hemodialysis. Additionally, the authors also assessed the impact of residual kidney function on beta-2 microglobulin by comparing the results of previously reported measure data with model predictions. As the authors describe in the results section, in the low flux and high flux arms of the HEMO study, the median beta-2 microglobulin concentration ratios could be matched by the dialyzer clearances of 5.2 and 26 ml per minute, respectively. The median pre-dialysis serum beta-2 microglobulin levels were matched if the generation rates of beta-2 microglobulin were set to approximately 240 milligrams per day. Modeling predicted that post-dilution hemodiafiltration using 25 liters per 4-hour replacement fluid would lower the serum time-averaged concentration of beta-2 microglobulin by about 18%, similar to the effect of 1.5 ml per minute residual kidney glomerular filtration rate. The study does have some limitations, including the fact that this has not been tested for utility in providing information about individual patients, and particularly those patients who have a pre-dialysis value of serum beta-2 microglobulin or volumes of distribution of beta-2 microglobulin outside of the expected ranges. Another limitation of the model is that it does not account for the substantial membrane absorption of beta-2 microglobulin by some dialyzer membranes. Nevertheless, the article is quite important, and as the authors conclude, a two-pool kinetic model of beta-2 microglobulin yielded values of reduction ratio and pre-dialysis serum concentration that were consistent with the measured values with various hemodiafiltration and hemodialysis treatment regimens.
Thank you, Sagar, for highlighting this exceptional article. I will now be discussing our last article of the July CJSN podcast on development and validation of kidney replacement therapy knowledge, the NO-KRT instrument, in which the corresponding author is Dr. Ashutosh Shukla. The underlying premise for this innovative study is that while greater awareness of kidney replacement therapies is associated with greater home dialysis use as a more patient-centered treatment approach for end-stage kidney disease, there are a lack of validated instruments that evaluate patients' knowledge and awareness of various kidney replacement therapies that can better inform shared decision-making. To address this clinical gap, the investigators developed a novel 24-item kidney replacement therapy knowledge instrument known as the NO-KRT, and then conducted a cross-sectional study among U.S. veterans with advanced CKD to determine its reliability, dimensionality, and validity. In developing the NO-KRT instrument, the investigators utilized a modified 9-step psychometric scale development process in which a team of kidney disease providers, nurses, dietitians, and social workers developed and refined a kidney disease knowledge instrument, resulting in a final 24-item NO-KRT instrument focused on three kidney replacement therapy-specific conceptual domains, including number one, a general domain comprised of nine items representing the basic talking points for kidney replacement therapy in the general population that included items asking participants to choose different types of kidney replacement therapy modalities from their descriptions. Number two, a technical domain consisting of 11 items requiring greater understanding of time, effort, and financial commitment of various kidney replacement therapies. And number three, a correlative domain consisting of four items focused on complex understandings of different lifestyle preferences and their relations with various kidney replacement therapies. The final instrument also underwent further refinement to ensure its readability and use of patient-friendly language. The instrument was then tested among 256 U.S. veterans as part of the ongoing Teach Vet trial, a trial for evaluating and assessing the impact of comprehensive pre-kidney failure patient education on home dialysis among veterans. With respect to the main findings, the NO-KRT instrument with three domains was found to have acceptable internal consistency, reliability, and validity. In this study population, the NO-KRT score also had a strong and significant correlation with CKD knowledge, with a correlation coefficient of 0.68, while kidney replacement therapy and CKD awareness correlated negatively with age and positively with health literacy, employment status, hypertension, and quality of nephrology care. I took particular interest in this article, given that the investigators' efforts to address a critical gap will help expand access to more patient-centered treatment options for ESKD under the Advancing American Kidney Health Initiative, and given its focus on U.S. veterans in whom there is lower penetration of home dialysis. The investigators should be applauded for their development of a first-of-its-kind instrument that measures kidney replacement therapy-related knowledge for informed dialysis decision-making. Further studies are needed to confirm its dimensionality and role in guiding targeted patient education efforts for greater home dialysis use.
This concludes our July CJSON podcast. On behalf of our CJSON deputy editors and editorial team, I would like to express our gratitude to the authors of these articles for their important contributions to the journal, and also to all of you for dialing in. We look forward to connecting with you next time.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.